This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Arbella Studios' Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. Emmanuel, in theaters June 17th and 19th only. More information is available at emmanuelmovie.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Great to have you with us again, everybody. Psalm 119 asks, how can a young man keep his way pure? By keeping it according to your word. Amen to that. In fact, every young man engages in all kinds of battles these days, which include not just the battle for purity, but other things as well. We're going to explore this topic today with Jonathan McKee, who runs thesourceforparents.com and has over 20 years in youth ministry. His latest book is called The Guy's Guide to Four Battles Every Young Man Must Face. And Jonathan, it's great to talk to you again. How are you?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me on again.
Always nice to talk to you. There are really a lot of battles, aren't there, that guys face? How do you decide which four battles to reduce it to? Because I can think of probably 20 off the top of my head. How do you reduce it? I guess you just have to pick four and say these are the main ones.
I know, right? This is just one of those things where, you know, there's a lot of distractions in this world, but these are the four that are the overwhelming ones that when it comes to, when I do a parent workshop, these are the questions parents come up and ask me. These are the things that when I'm talking with youth leaders, that youth leaders are like, oh man, I've got a kid who is, you know, addicted to these pictures he's looking at that he shouldn't be looking at, you know, or a mom saying, what do I do when, you know, if I don't monitor my kid's video game time, he'll go 12 hours straight on Fortnite. You know, I mean, these are kind of the big things right now. And I thought, man, we got to address them because sadly, a lot of parents go, you know, quickly to tightening the grip. Let's give me some quick rules. Give me some quick parental controls to block this stuff. And sadly, you know, as much as those help, they're great, we need to actually talk about this stuff. We need conversation. And so that's what really this resource is. It's a guide not just to hand our kids, but to say, hey, let's go to breakfast. Let's talk about some of this stuff. Let's talk about video games. Video games can be fun, but how can they not master us? So these are the conversations we need to have.
For sure. And you've got a note to mom or dad screening this book, which I want to talk about just briefly, because one of the things that you're emphasizing is mom and dad, you may think you understand what your son faces, but it's kind of not the way it used to be back in your day. How have things changed in your estimation? What do parents need to know about how the battles have morphed, as it were, into this day?
That's a great question, Jenna. And because a lot of us, though, sometimes as parents, we think, well, when I was a kid, you know, there was some of these temptations, there was some of these distractions, you know, and we can think about that. But there's two big changes, and the big changes are more accessibility, less accountability. Yeah. And I say more accessibility simply because, I mean, we live in a world now where, I mean, you know, the average young person gets, you know, a mobile device in their pocket at 10.3 years old. They spend over 9 hours a day soaking in entertainment media. And so, I mean, they've got, you know, I mean, think about all they have in their pocket. They got Google in their pocket. They got Netflix in their pocket. They've got, you know, Spotify in their pocket. So they've got every musical artist. They follow their profiles on Instagram. So their heroes are now, you know, Drake, you know, Post Malone, Cardi B, and a lot of parents probably aren't even familiar with what they're actually hearing from these role models in their pocket. But I mean, this is a huge issue. Young people are so, you know, absolutely saturated in this. The accessibility with this device is, you know, the images, the distractions they have are following them everywhere, into their bedroom, into the bathroom, you know, on their, you know, way to school, in the park, alone by themselves, hence the less accountability. We have more accessibility, less accountability. So this is why we need to really help our kids understand, since they're so saturated in this, we need to talk to them about truth in a world so overflowing with lies.
Well, we do. Let's talk about screens a little bit. I'm going to jump around to some of these battles that you describe in the book.
Fun.
But when we're talking about screens, the accessibility thing really is daunting to parents, because you can't be doing 24/7 monitoring of your kid's smartphone all the time or internet all the time. There are times that you're just not going to be hovering over the computer screen or the smartphone of your kid. And a lot of parents feel a little bit of despair and say, what do I do? Do I get rid of the phone? Do I, you know, how do I you know, help my son make good choices when we know that he can do all kinds of things when we're not around. This seems to be an ongoing struggle for a lot of families, probably all of them.
No, absolutely. And it's reasonable for us to want to protect them. I mean, that's a good thing. And some good loving guardrails and boundaries can be helpful. Whenever I'm in a parent workshop, I show them the research. I mean, from Common Sense Media to the American Academy of Pediatrics, most of these guys recommend delaying smartphones till teen years at least, if not freshman year of high school, which is weird because, you know, the average age that young people get smartphones is 10 years old. And for these experts to be saying, no, don't rush this. You know, wait till, I mean, literally Bill Gates, the Common Sense Media president, all these guys, you ask them what they did with their own kids, they waited to give their kids a smartphone till high school.
Yep.
So these are things I share with parents so that they're not denying their kids these devices, but maybe they're delaying them a little bit. I talked to them about social media and the fact that, you know, they aren't even supposed to be on social media till age 13. As a matter of fact, if they wanted to be on Instagram or Snapchat or some of their favorite social medias before then, they actually have to lie about their age. So that's one of those no-brainers where we could say, no, sorry. You know, the answer is not no, it's just not yet. It's like your driver's license. You know, you got to wait till you're the right age there. So there's so some of those boundaries, and also like no phones in the bedroom. You know, hey, it's nighttime. I'm mom or dad. I'm going to provide a free service for you, and we're going to charge your phone for you. And we'll give you a fresh, you know, fresh charge device in the morning. These are the things that all the experts recommend. The scary thing is that even when we do all that stuff, these same experts will say, hey, you know what? Your kids still have, you know, access to this stuff. They still go to their friend's house. They're still, you know, even if you deny them all screens, what's going to stop their friend at school from walking up and saying, hey, check this out? You know, I mean, so that's why we need to not just overreact and try to ban everything, but we need to interact with them, and we need to equip them with truth so that they recognize these lies when they see them. So it takes conversation, and that's what this book's about. It's having conversations about some of these things so they can recognize the truth.
Jonathan, if you had to pinpoint one biggest issue with screens that is the most dangerous or the most problematic for young men these days, what would it be? Would it be porn, the access to porn? Would it be screen time in general is dumbing us down, keeping us from reading and thinking properly, you know, distracting us, these sorts of things? Is there one particular concern that would be elevated among, you know, all the concerns that people might have about screen time?
Yeah, that's a huge question, because on one hand, I think the biggest distraction that young people are, that the experts are talking about is saying video games with young men, and it's social media with young women. And of course, when it comes to screens in general, you ask experts like, you know, Dr. Jean Twenge out of San Diego State University. You know, she wrote her book iGen, and pretty much the summary of that book is, hey, the more time young people spend on social media, the more depressed they are. And for sure, since 2012, which is when our country crossed the 50% mark for smartphone ownership, 2012 is when Instagram came out, 2012 is when Snapchat emerged. That's when all this stuff started to basically, social media got into our pocket in 2012. From 2012 till now, we've seen an unprecedented rise in depression, anxiety, teen suicide among young girls. I mean, it's going crazy to where everybody's going, what's going on? And everybody's talking about screen time. And many of us even remember last year, both Apple's iOS and Droid all came out with, all of a sudden, because of the pressure, because everybody was saying, you guys are trying to addict us to our devices. You guys are evil. So they came up with these screen time and parental control features that were on an update in the fall, and all of a sudden, all of us remember, oh, wow, now we can set our phone where we can monitor our screen time, and we can set the hours and stuff. So screen time is a huge issue. But to answer your question, I think the biggest issue is self-esteem. Right now, I think both guys and girls are asking, who am I? Where do I fit in? And we now got a device in our pocket that follows us around everywhere, and this device is kind of a barometer of self-esteem, because now our self-esteem is caught up in this device so much. How many friends do you have? I don't know. Let me check.
Right.
You know, how are things going? Are you popular? Do you have lots of, you know, well, I don't know. Let me see how I'm trending right now with that last post. That last post didn't go so well. We're so kind of caught up on now our social media status and how many friends we are that it's creating so many different problems, because one, I mean, you've got kids that want to be more popular, they want to have more friends, they want to have more followers. So now they're kind of saying yes to everybody So now we've got pedophiles loving this world because they can, you know, friend request, and kids are so quick to say yes because our self-esteem is based on how many followers we have.
Well, hang on, so Jonathan. We're going to go to a break very quickly. Hang on. Guy's Guide to Four Battles Every Young Man Must Face. We'll come back right after this. Socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create enemies within the church, a hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. We encourage you to partner with enemies within the church and help them complete this important project. To learn how to help and to stay updated about the film, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com. And while you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. Enemieswithinthechurch.com.
From Arbella Studios comes Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. A new documentary that examines the history of race relations in Charleston and the hope for healing that emerged out of a senseless act of terror.
That act of forgiving people is the greatest act of love that one could ever experience.
So I forgive you, my family forgive you.
Emmanuel, in theaters June 17th and 19th only. More information is available at emmanuelmovie.com.
If you're looking for adventure, serving as a volunteer on the Mercy Ship is an adventure like no other. And you'll be serving on the largest non-governmental hospital ship in the world, providing free care to some of the world's poorest people. Whether it's performing a surgery, cleaning the deck, or transporting a patient to a recovery center, every day you'll be making a difference in the lives of struggling people. Begin your adventure today. Connect with us at mercyships.org. It's an adventure of a lifetime.
We're back on Janet Mefford today. Jonathan McKee is joining us to talk about Guy's Guide to Four Battles Every Young Man Must Face, a manual to overcoming life's common distractions. It is a different world, maybe, for you and your kids today than it was for you when you were the same age as your son. And we are learning some of these battles that young men face these days. Talking a little bit, as you mentioned, about self-image. And you were saying, Jonathan, that this is something that a lot of young men do struggle with. Who am I? And am I really, you know, the person who doesn't have as good a selfie as the other guy on social media? Or maybe it's, I don't have enough followers, or I don't have this, or I'm not this enough or that enough. What do you advise as far as young men finding their identity in Jesus Christ and really getting grounded in who they are apart from the screens and apart from what the crowd says and all the rest of the temptations and the pressures that young men face every single day?
Well, absolutely. And that's where, when we have these conversations with young men, we need to talk about this, because the device in their pocket, you know, says that our identity is so caught up in how many friends we have, you know, and how we measure up and all this. And for us, you know, the more we, and again, our typical response as parents is, oh, let me try to block out all these lies. When we need to remember, no, let's keep plugging them into the truth. So one of the best things we can do for our kids' self-esteem is to get them focused on Christ, to get them focused on Jesus. And that's why it's amazing, like a guide like this, man, I'm constantly going to Scripture. When it comes to talking about self-esteem, I love them to look at the person of Jesus. I love them to look at, you know, Jesus, who walked around, and when he encountered a guy by the name of Zacchaeus, who is this guy who was ripping everybody off and was very unpopular with everybody else. As a matter of fact, most people are leaving like, oh, you don't want to hang out with that guy. Jesus is like, hey, man, let's go to dinner. And he connected with him. Jesus wasn't scared to connect with the woman at the well, who was this kind of outcast. And she was even like, whoa, why are you talking to me? And his message to these people was always the same. It's kind of like, man, I don't care about your past mistakes, but I do care about your future. And it was amazing. The more we look at Jesus and who he is and our identity that, you know, man, I tell you, as a Christ follower, you know, we don't need to be caught up in who we are, but who Christ is in us.
Right.
It's not a look at me, look how good I am, which is what so much of social media is. Look at me, like me. It's no, look at him in me. And that's where it's kind of fun to actually talk about serving, talk about some of the different things we can do, because kids want to make a difference, and it makes a huge impact on who they are when they feel like, I'm making a difference in others. I'm making a difference for Christ. I'm making an eternal difference.
Yeah, that's so good. One of the things, as long as we're on the subject of social media, one of the things that I often will tell my kids is, do you know how many followers Jesus had at the end of his life when he was hanging on the cross? Everybody abandoned him. Jesus had no followers.
Yeah.
You know, he had followers, obviously, after he was risen from the dead. But think about that for a moment. It, your number of followers has nothing to do with your identity or who you are or how important you are to God at all.
Yeah, and this is the kind of thing that if we can be talking with them about this. And one of the pieces of good news I always give parents is all the research. I mean, as a social researcher, I'm constantly reading these reports. Pew Research did this report last fall that was eye-opening, where they asked young people about their screen time and basically how happy it made them. And 54% of teenagers said, I think I spend too much time on a screen. And there was another report that came out right around the same time where it was asking the same similar questions. And 69% of 12 through 17-year-olds said, I wish I could engage in more face-to-face conversations, less screen-to-screen conversations. So it's like there's kind of this feeling of, hey, there's something more out there. And so these are huge opportunities for us, you know, plugging kids into good stuff in the church and in Bible studies. And you know, so, but, and this is the conversation we talk about all throughout this book. When I'm talking about all four of these battles of screens, substances, sexual temptation, self-esteem, one thing that keeps coming up is who we're hanging out with, who we're connecting with, and how much that affects us. So that's one of the things we constantly encourage them in this book.
Yes. Now, one of the things that you point out when you were giving that warning to parents that it ain't like it used to be, I think is how you said it. You mentioned marijuana. And marijuana has been around, obviously, but it's in a more potent form, and it's now legal in many places. So what sorts of difficulties does this pose for families today in terms of drug abuse? I mean, drug abuse is really bad in this country. We talk about the opioid crisis, but even when we're talking about substances like marijuana, I mean, kids have a lot of temptations in that regard. What are your thoughts on it all?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard because right now there's all these arguments that, you know, that they can find easily a couple clicks away on their screen where they find people talking about how, oh, don't worry about marijuana. It's no big deal, you know, and there'll be some truth to when they'll say, like, you know, opiates are what are really bad. Drinking, you know, and, you know, is what's really bad. That's what kills people. Marijuana doesn't kill anybody. Matter of fact, only 26.7% of 12th graders graduating from high school think that marijuana offers any risk of harm at all. So you've got about 75%, three quarters of these high school kids graduating are sitting there going, hey, marijuana's no big deal. I mean, 35.9% of 12th graders have used marijuana in the last year.
Wow.
So this is huge. Most of our kids, you know, one in three of 12th graders are using it. So I mean, everybody's got friends who use. Most people say it's no big deal. The thing that's interesting is, where most of these debates are about either legalization or should we use it in medicinal contexts and this and that, we don't even need to have those debates with young men. As a matter of fact, the thing I, you know, talk about in this book and the thing that I talk about with parents and say, hey, here's a conversation we should have with our kids, is what applies to them and say, hey, you know what, hey, we could talk legalization or you know, whether or not it's good for, you know, grandma, you know, whether it makes her feel better after her chemotherapy. But let's talk about what relates to you, and that is the effect on the developing brain. Because even pro-pot advocates don't even want to get into that debate because it's such an obvious risk factor for the developing brain. And developing brain for a young man is up to 25 years old.
Oh, wow.
And most every expert out there is saying, hey, you know what, if you want to use it someday, you know, go ahead, you know, but don't do it while your brain is developing. So that's one of the things I really focus on in the book when it comes, because we talk about other things too. We talk about drinking. We talk about drugs. I tell stories of you know, a friend of mine who was a coke user and how it started with marijuana, how it moved on to that. And, and these are the dialogues we have, talking about this. But when it comes to marijuana, I just say, hey, just understand something. You know, the reason it's still, you know, even the people who are legalizing it aren't legalizing it for young people. You know why? They know the effect it has on the young brain.
Right.
So bare minimum, you know, even we don't even need to get into it. And I give them little dabs of the fact that it's linked to psychosis and all kinds of other stuff if you decide to use it later. But right now, for sure, it's the absolute worst time to use marijuana. And we need to talk to young people about that. And a lot of us aren't having those conversations.
Yeah, alcohol too. I mean, there are myriad problems with alcohol, not only because of the drinking age, but also drunk driving, alcoholism in the family, abuse being tied to alcohol use. I mean, there's so many reasons to warn your son about the dangerous effects of alcohol. And yet we're always seeming to fight against this cultural idea that, you know, that's part of the party. You know, if you really want to have fun, you got to have beer. You got to have this. You got to have that. I mean, that's also a conundrum, I think, for many parents, especially if you have parents who are drinkers. So, you know.
Yeah. It's tough because, and of course, every piece of entertainment media, even very innocent entertainment media, you know, some of the most innocent movies we see, the celebrations at the end of something is always like, you know, let's get completely wasted,
yeah.
You know, let's get drunk with alcohol. And it's hard because, you know, some Christians will disagree on whether it's good to just, you know, have a glass of wine or not. It's like, we don't even enter that. The thing I talk with young people about alcohol is, hey guys, you know, I talk about the driving, I talk about drinking too much, and I even tell a story, a true story, of a friend of mine who had a couple beers after playing golf, got in his car to drive home, felt fine, got pulled over, and he was like, oh, well, no big deal. And he took the little, you know, sobriety test that the police performed right there, and he failed because he was dehydrated because he'd been out in the sun for 5 hours golfing with his buddies, and literally with two beers, he had a DUI. DUIs cost over $10,000, suspends your license, it makes your insurance go up to, you know, I mean, so I just talk about some of these things. I say, you know what, these are the things that movies never show.
Right,
you know?
Of course.
These are the things that we don't even think about, and we need to think about our choices have consequences. We need to talk about these things with our kids.
It's very important. I think that's all really important. And it reminds me of the Bible saying that don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Holy Spirit. That's another opportunity to go back to our sons and say, this is what God's plan is for you. And it seems to me that kind of an overarching theme for our sons needs to be, if you are a Christian, if you truly are born again by the Spirit of God and you belong to Jesus Christ, then you're not like the world. That seems to be a recurring theme for a lot of Christian parents, to say, this is what I'm ultimately trying to teach you, that there is something better that God has for you than all of these distractions and temptations that the world will constantly set before you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, this is the kind of thing that sometimes I think we as Christian parents, we think maybe, oh, well, you know, they know this. We don't need to talk, you know, they know to say no to drugs.
Yeah.
You know, and we sometimes just assume, I mean, my kids are all out of the house. And as I looked back, you know, if I had a parenting do-over, I would have talked about this more because I just kind of assumed that it was all fine. And I didn't really think, you know, that, you know, this would be an issue. I tell you, in our culture right now, this is one of those things that is a huge issue that young people think is no big deal.
Yeah.
And we need to just share them the truth. We don't need to try to scare them into, you know, don't ever touch anything. But
yeah.
More like give them good information, more than just drugs are bad. But give them good information about, hey, here's some real stories of what can happen. And I tell you, one of the things I always recommend to parents is, I think it's good to take young people to homeless shelters, take them to, you know, expose them to different people, bring people in youth ministries. I tell them, bring someone in who struggles with this, who's an alcoholic, to share their story. These real life stories kind of counter some of these it's no big deal messages they hear all the time.
Well,
and this is the kind
good.
Of information that helps them think.
Oh, for sure. Very, very good. Jonathan McKee, Guy's Guide to Four Battles Every Young Man Must Face. Jonathan, so good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, always a pleasure.
All right. God bless. We'll be back. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Arbella Studios Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. Emmanuel, in theaters June 17th and 19th only. More information is available at emmanuelmovie.com. Welcome back to Janet Meffer Today. We have often talked on this show about the outsized influence of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and the unindicted co-conspirator in the Hamas funding trial. CARE is always out there trying to position itself as the spokesman for moderate Islam. But in reality, as the Investigative Project on Terrorism has noted, it seems that its primary goals are to silence and delegitimize its critics and redefine what it means to be a moderate Muslim. Here's a case in point. Raymond Ibrahim is a Middle East and Islam specialist whose work as an author and writer has been widely published. He is exceptional on the issue of Muslim persecution of Christians, for example. And he's also guest lectured at universities and briefed governmental agencies like the U.S. Strategic Command and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Well, just recently, Raymond was invited by the U.S. Army War College to come and deliver a lecture this week based on his book, Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. But that invitation was rescinded after CARE and Muslim agitator Linda Sarsour engaged in a big smear campaign against him. Raymond is joining us now to tell us what happened, and it's so great to have you with us, Raymond. Thank you for being here.
Very good to be with you, Janet. Thanks for having me.
Well, I am really upset about this. This is a really maddening story. Can you take us back to the beginning when you first got this invitation to speak about your book? What was said and how did it unfold?
Sure. In January of this year, I got an invitation from the U.S. Army War College, which was, I can actually read a part of it. It said, Mr. Ibrahim, on behalf of et cetera, I'm honored to invite you to speak as part of the War College 2019 Perspectives in Military History Lecture Series. We would like you to speak about your new book, Sword and Scimitar. And then he wrote, on a personal note, I think your new book and a lecture on it will resound very well with the primary audience of our lecture programs, the students and faculty of the U.S. Army War College. And, you know, we back and forth, we settled on a date and other logistical matters. And that was the end of it until CARE got involved.
Unbelievable. So how did CARE get involved? And were you aware when they first started taking notice and agitating against you?
No, I didn't. They actually sent a letter on May 28th to the heads of the U.S. Army War College, the Pennsylvania chapter of CARE. The heads, three of them signed it. I have their names. And they sent it to the heads. Basically, the whole thing, and I can read to you a little excerpt. They basically wrote that Raymond Ibrahim's book, Sword and Scimitar, advances a simplistic, inaccurate, and often prejudicial view of the long history of Muslim-West relations, which we find troubling. But at the same time, in that long letter they sent, they didn't cite one sentence from my 352-page book to support their accusation. At any rate, I found out about it because a few days after that letter, a reporter contacted me. He was writing a story about it, and he wanted my insights, and I gave him some. But the letter was written in a very formal, and it was all about the deep disappointments and frustration of the Muslim community that you're inviting a notorious Islamophobe. These are all quotes in the letter. But otherwise, compared to what came after, in retrospect, it was a very measured and rational sounding letter. And the War College responded by A, not responding to CARE, and B, calling me to reassure me that the event is still on and they are definitely not going to back down.
But it
then,
Go ahead. Linda Sarsour got involved.
Yeah, exactly. So then Linda Sarsour and CARE, like I think on the next day after I spoke to the War College on June 5th, on June 6th, CARE issued a petition. Now this one again, got a little. It was not like the measured letter. It was just lambasting and yelling and pointing out the War College hasn't even responded to us. He's an Islamophobe. He's going to incite. And then Linda Sarsour's group called M Power Change. They sent out a large petition, and this one was it's basically a hysterical screed that presents me, who is of Egyptian descent, an Arab speaker, native Arab speaker, right, whose parents came from Egypt, presenting me as, quote, a racist and, quote, a white nationalist who if I speak about my book before the War College will provoke and incite American soldiers to start randomly killing Muslims all around the world, including in the United States. And I can read you the excerpt. Okay, so here's a telling excerpt from Linda Sarsour's thing. She wrote, quote, just a few days ago, California Representative Duncan Hunter, who ran an explicitly Islamophobic campaign for Congress, casually admitted that he and his unit killed probably hundreds of civilians, probably killed women and children in Iraq. And then the next sentence, which is in bold and underlined, says, held at U.S. Army War College, Ibrahim's lecture on his book would push the same kind of incendiary Islamophobic rhetoric that has led to violence inflicted on Muslim communities, both in the U.S. and abroad.
Wow.
And also in all these screeds, you know, because it all centers around the book, Sword and Scimitar, and they, you know, they discuss it and they attack and say it's ahistorical, et cetera, but again, not once in the press release or Sarsour's do they actually excerpt one sentence to show how this is false.
It's so ridiculous. How do you even begin to analyze this? But I'm thinking, for example, how in the world would this lead to an outbreak of violence of American military forces against Muslims? It seems to me that we're, you know, many years hence since 9/11, that might have been the time when that would have happened if it ever did. And it never did. But also, wouldn't everybody have to have an outbreak of reading a 352-page book in order to be incited? I mean, how is your appearing at the War College going to incite anybody?
Well, I mean, it would incite, they're saying, the leadership of the War College, which would then apparently trickle down to your average soldier. But as you're pointing out, you know, what's interesting, you know, this is a book about history, and most of the events I discuss happened hundreds of years ago, some of them over 1,000 years ago. But I think CARE, and I give them a little bit of credit, because they understand what's at stake here. You know, a lot of, you know, the history, the Islamists and the left have really dominated the history of Islam vis-a-vis the West, and they presented a flowery picture of a sort of progressive, moderate Islam, and, you know, evil European Christian crusaders, and just were always ruining things and creating fights. But if you look at the history, it's just one long chronicle of ISIS-like behavior from the Islamic world in all its manifestations throughout the centuries, which means whether in its Arab or its Berber or its Tatar or Mongol or Turkish manifestations, they all, the heads of state, the sultans, the caliphs, the emirs, presented their war on the West as a jihad. They called it that. They quoted from the Quran. They quoted from Muhammad. They relished in enslaving European men and women and children, especially for sexual purposes. And all this went on. It was a bombardment that people don't even realize. You know, it went up to Iceland. They were actually getting slaves from Iceland and selling them in North Africa. And America's first war, before it could even elect its first president, Washington, was with Muslim slavers, the Barbary pirates, who, when they met Jefferson and John Adams, again told him, and Jefferson asked them, why are you attacking our soldiers, our sailors? What have we done to you? And the ambassador said, it's in our holy book, the Quran, that all who do not accept Muhammad are our enemies and we must do jihad, et cetera, et cetera. So I think CARE understands that if this sort of history gets out, and it's so well documented and you can't refute it, then the whole narrative is going to change. And there's no more talk of, well, what went wrong? Why do they hate us? The same questions that appeared after 9/11. Nothing went wrong, and they've hated us from the start.
Right.
That's what the history really shows.
Right.
So I think that's what they want to keep bottled up.
I think you're right. So what did the War College say to you when they decided to rescind your invitation?
So the War College's official position to me and to the media is that they have, quote-unquote, postponed the lecture.
Okay.
And by which this is really what they're doing. They're caving in, and they're canceling because it's canceled. It was supposed to be this Wednesday, and it's not. And they're telling everyone that we're postponed. And they're also saying, according to media reports, that their decision had nothing to do with CARE or all these petitions. This is just a decision that they just happened to take 2-3 days after Linda Sarsour and CARE started their smear campaign, and only a week before my scheduled talk, which was scheduled 6 months ago. So it's obvious it's a cancellation, but they're trying to, you know, put a veneer and save face. And I know what's going to happen when the time comes to, because they didn't offer me any dates. They just said, oh, we're postponing and we'll get back to you, which basically means we're hushing it up and, you know, we're calling it a postponement and nice knowing you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so many problems with that. But one of the things that I want to get into when we come back from this break is more about what could have led and likely did lead to this so-called postponement of your speaking at the U.S. Army War College. Raymond Ibrahim with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today.
We'll be right back.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. Socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create enemies within the church. A hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. We encourage you to partner with enemies within the church and help them complete this important project. To learn how to help and to stay updated about the film, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com. And while you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. enemieswithinthechurch.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Thank you for joining us. Raymond Ibrahim is my guest, Islamic expert and specialist. He's been a wonderful source for news about Islam and the Muslim persecution of Christians over the years. Very well known. He's out with a new book called Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, and was recently, shall we say, disinvited by the U.S. Army War College to come and talk about that book after a smear campaign put on by CARE, the unindicted co-conspirator in the Hamas funding trial, along with Muslim activist Linda Sarsour. Now, we were talking, Raymond, before we went to the break about how they phrased this. They say, oh, it's postponed. You know, don't call us. We'll call you and that sort of thing. But you also have indicated that there may have been more to it than just the CARE smear campaign pertaining to the Muslim community in the area. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The latest I've been getting, I've been getting tons of emails since this has started. The overwhelming majority of them are supportive. A lot of them are from people who identify themselves as at the War College. They're very disappointed. They're apologizing. Others are from military men who've written to the War College and shared their pretty angry letters with me. But I've also been getting emails from people who identify themselves. And again, I say identify because I don't know anything. You know, they come on my website through my contact form. I don't know if it's a real name. Some aren't signed. But people are saying that in the Harrisburg community, which has apparently, I didn't know this, I've never been to Harrisburg before, that apparently has a large Muslim community, that there was a sort of tension involved, a sort of a palpable fear. These are actually quotes I took from the letters, that Muslims were angry and that there might be some sort of backlash, and that where I'm thinking may have also contributed to the War College's decision. But why, you know, normally I wouldn't have even mentioned this if it was just emails, because I don't know, you know, the veracity of it until this point. I'm on record saying I can't claim any of this. But what I do find interesting is that if you go back to the initial letter I was talking about, the more measured one that was sent on May 28th by Jacob Bender and other CARE leadership of Pennsylvania, they wrote this, and I'm going to quote it. They wrote, "Indeed, as word of Mr. Ibrahim's upcoming lecture has spread, we have been contacted by Muslims and interfaith allies from all over Pennsylvania, and especially from the Harrisburg area, which houses over a dozen mosques, who called us to express their shock that such a prestigious institution as Army War College would invite and confer legitimacy on an individual who spreads historical falsehoods about their faith, the faith of 1.6 billion Muslims and the fastest growing religion in the United States." So in light of what I'm now being told, this almost reads like a veiled threat.
Yeah. Wow. So basically, they just exercise the heckler's veto and they get whatever they want, even though the people at the War College desperately need to hear the information you were about to present.
Apparently. And, you know, Harrisburg, if it has over a dozen mosques, that's a lot of that's a large Muslim community. Not many cities have that many mosques.
No, that is a lot.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know you're going to be in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, the day you were supposed to be delivering that lecture, and you're meeting with members of Congress and the military. What is on tap for you on Wednesday?
Well, I can't really divulge who and all this at this point because they haven't necessarily told me that I can or should.
Sure.
But there's a lot of people who I've been connected with and have reached out to me in Congress and in the military in D.C., and I'm set to have a lot of meetings about this. And I'll be happy to come on later and talk to you about what develops. So I can't really tell what will develop, if anything, but hopefully something positive.
Good. I hope so. Now, I'd love to revisit you with you on this issue, because this is a broader problem. We have seen this sort of thing go on over a lot of years. I know I've done a lot of coverage on these sorts of things where CARE gets mad and they hold a press conference and the media jumps in and they start taking their side, even though there's not any shred of truth to what they're saying. I mean, on its face, Raymond, they're calling you a white nationalist and a racist, but you're an ethnic Egyptian. I mean, that should have been laughed out of the state of Pennsylvania right there, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, and this is the scary precedent that I think, as you're saying, this has happened a lot, but I think this one's unprecedented in two ways. One, that the accusations are so ludicrous. I mean, if someone of European descent is accused of a racist, even though they're not, all right, you can see the ostensible connection,
right?
Not that they necessarily are.
Right.
But now you say it about someone like me, one, and two, that sort of pathetic allegations works with not just a liberal college, but the U.S. Army War College. I mean, so who can ever speak or hear about Islam again in this context? And by the way, according to the Task and Force, it's one of the earliest reports, they pointed out that this is it's unprecedented for such a campaign to be launched against a U.S. military institution as opposed to a regular college. And they still capitulated.
That's scary, because we really need to keep the truth out there. And what was it that you were going to be focusing on? I know that the subtitle of your book has to do with the Islam in the West and some of the things that you were mentioning a few minutes ago. But what was the crux of what you were to present to those at the War College that is really vital for them to hear?
Basically, the whole lecture, I was told what they wanted was about the book, my book, Sword and Scimitar. So I was gonna summarize the findings of this long book, 352 pages, and present it. And I think what CARE is afraid of is they're going to see that, you know, as opposed to the narrative, the historical narrative that they push and leftist historians push and really dominates the West, even anti-Islamist types who will grab the Quran and cite Muhammad really usually fall for the pseudo-history that exists because it's so unquestioned. So I think they're trying to keep this history, which essentially shows that from the beginning, from Islam's first contact with Western civilization in the 7th century, up until the colonial era when Islam got defanged, so for well over 1,000 years, an array, centuries worth of sultans and caliphs and emirs, whether they were Berbers or Mongols or Tatars or Turks or Persians or Arabs, all spoke like ISIS and all behaved like ISIS vis-a-vis the West. So think of all the atrocities that ISIS has done while quoting the Quran, but on an exponential level, exponential scale, bombarding every corner of Europe for a millennium. So I think if people get wind of that, they're not, the narrative is going to start to crumble, as I was pointing out. And I think they're trying to, and by the way, because CARE, the people who have been writing about this and petitioning, Linda Sarsour, none of these people have credentials in the discipline of history. And let me just read to you a couple of quotes from actual historians, what they say of the book. So Victor Davis Hanson, essentially America's leading military historian and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, wrote, Sword and Scimitar is first-rate military history and a product of solid scholarship and philological research. And now look at this quote from Professor Paul Crawford. He's a Crusades historian. He wrote, Sword and Scimitar is a refreshingly honest account of Islamic expansion and Christian reaction that provides useful insights into today's problems. And then he says this, this is history as it should be done, allowing the past to inform and guide the present rather than distorting the past to fit contemporary political ideologies, which is what's been going on up until now.
Right, right. Well, as I have mentioned to you before, I read your stuff constantly. Every time something new comes out from you on the Muslim persecution of Christians, which you do every month, you know, I read all this, and it's such helpful information for somebody like me, so I can bring it to listeners so people can be informed. What really concerns me, though, Raymond, is when you see the success that CARE has with these kinds of tactics, obviously what they want to do is silence dissent. But do you think that people are grasping the importance, you know, if you allow CARE to win these little battles here and there, and now it's to this level of unprecedented, you know, attack on somebody like yourself, where does that leave us? I mean, we're basically walking into the exact warning that you are issuing to all of us.
It leaves us in a very bad place. You know, I mean, it's gotten, like I said, this particular incident is, I think, the worst, not because it's me, but because of who I am, my ethnic background, and who was inviting me and who ended up capitulating, the War College. You know, at this point, can you expect any college, any institution to, you know, not back down, especially if the speaker is of European heritage and they call him a racist? It's, you know, if they can get away with this with me and the War College, I don't foresee the truth about Islamist ideology and history really getting out to the people that most need to hear it.
Well, I agree. Do you draw any conclusions about all of the information that was circulated during the time of the Obama administration about the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood into the government itself? Do you see any sort of connection whatsoever between CARE gaining ground in this sort of incident and the past where people have said, hey, we're getting a lot more of these types in the government and it's really having an effect?
No, they're absolutely right, and this incident just completely proves it. It's happened before. You know, it's Stephen Coughlin and so many other people who all they did is present, you know, documented, you know, scholarly works that were apparently unflattering to the image of Islam, and they've immediately been silenced. And this is how CARE and its Islamist organizers work, organizations work. And it's sad because, you know, they play the victim card, where in the Middle East and the Islamic world, they're the predators, not minorities like Christians.
Oh, you're so right. Well, Raymond, we appreciate your work. We really appreciate your being with us and keep us up to speed on what's going on. We'll be praying for you. Thank you so much for telling us what's going on.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me, Janet.
Oh, my pleasure, Raymond. Take care. Hope to talk to you again soon and get an update. This hour, Janet Mefford Today, brought to you by Arbella Studios, Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. Emmanuel, in theaters Wednesday only. More information available at emmanuelmovie.com. We'll see you next time.